Welcome to the Hogan Lovells Litigation Landscape podcast series. These episodes will focus on the legal issues affecting businesses during COVID-19 disruption and beyond. Our team of global lawyers will help you navigate through these challenging times by providing expert insights and practical suggestions, giving you the tools you need to mitigate your risk and ensure stability.
Hello, and welcome to today's podcast. In a post-COVID-19 world, virtual hearings are becoming part of the new normal, and today we will be discussing what clients need to know about virtual hearings. I'm Kate Stetson, a partner in our Washington, D.C. office, and today I'm virtually joined by Kent Phillips from our Singapore office, Sema Haridi from our New York office, Edward Hickman from our London office, and Al Lindsay out of our Miami office. Thank you, everyone, for joining me to discuss this topic. As you've all seen, there's been a lot of information related to the use of virtual hearings in both litigation and arbitration. But I think it's important to discuss how virtual hearings affect clients. So let's jump right in with a question for you, Sema. From a client's viewpoint, what are some of the pros and cons of a virtual hearing? And are there certain types of cases or issues that are better suited for virtual hearings?
Certainly, the times that we're in and the global pandemic that we are living through has forced us to consider different ways in which to interact and continue to conduct business. And in our business of litigation and arbitration, we've had to take a very hard look at ways in which we could continue to work on matters and bring these matters to conclusion while not being able to be physically together. And of course, as Kate has just said, there's been a lot of talk about virtual hearings. And in arbitration, which is the area that I practice in, there's been a lot of discussion around the notion of virtual merits hearings and to what extent these are possible. And I will say, certainly, there are pros and cons to virtual hearings. And certainly, especially given the uncertainty that we're in and the fact that we just don't know how long the current situation will last and when we will all be able to gather up in rooms again, it is important to think about those cases that are sensitive. There may be issues such as bankruptcy looming or critical sensitive IP issues at stake, or other matters that require an urgent determination for which maybe parties simply cannot wait until such time as we can meet in person to have those issues decided. So one of the main pros, of course, of a virtual hearing is that it allows for time-sensitive issues to be addressed promptly. Also, there are, of course, many efficiency considerations. In fact, I suspect that when we go back to a time where hearings can be had in person, we will be giving second thoughts to whether it makes sense to have those hearings in person in situations and disputes that involve parties from different parts of the world, maybe smaller amounts in dispute, relatively small numbers of witnesses, such that it may, from an efficiency and cost perspective, not make sense to have and hold a physical hearing. So there are efficiency considerations to keep in mind, but that is not to say that every dispute is appropriate for a virtual hearing. Certainly, I would say that those disputes that are more centered around legal issues and argument may be easier to handle virtually. Conversely, when you have a dispute where many, many factual issues are at stake, many factual witnesses are participating and experts are participating, and that involve, in addition, I would add, different time zones, then it becomes tricky, to say the least, to hold a virtual hearing. it also raises questions as to whether it does make sense to hear witnesses testify virtually when a lot of the decision-making process will hinge on what those witnesses have to say. Would the tribunal members be more comfortable looking these witnesses in the eyes, so to speak, having them in the same room so as to be in a better place to assess their credibility? So I would say that not every case is necessarily appropriate for a virtual hearing. The global pandemic that we're in and the fact that we've all had to get used to trial by Zoom will have an impact on the future, will likely lead to an increase in the number of virtual hearings. But this is not to say that we will transition into a world where every dispute can be heard virtually. There is certainly room for disputes to continue to be heard in person.
So let me ask you this, and maybe one of the other panelists, Kent or Al, might be in a position to pick this up. Is that different? Are the pros and cons different for arbitration versus litigation?
Certainly there are differences. In terms of cons, right, you just can't do a jury trial, for example, virtually. And the problem isn't the technology or the lawyers. The problem is the jury. You can't guarantee they're not off surfing the net or, you know, or worse. In terms of presenting witnesses, you know, one of the pros is there, it's better than a telephone call, right? You can do it. First of all, it's available. As Sama said, if you're in an emergency situation, it allows you to do it. And the video allows a determination if you're presenting witnesses, for example, in a bench trial setting or in an arbitration setting before a tribunal. The demeanor of the witness can be viewed to some degree through the medium. But I think, you know, in terms of the cons and why you wouldn't always want to do it, even if you were appearing before a judge or a tribunal, there's something, you know, I consider a situational psychology. So, for example, when I take a deposition, I always put myself between the witness and the door. So the witness is sending a message, a psychological message that the witness kind of has to get through me before they leave. And there's certainly in court, in live testimony, whether it be court or arbitration, in court, for example, a witness, where do they sit? In a witness stand, right below the watchful eyes of the judge and next to the jury. In arbitration, it's maybe even more intimidating. The witness is sitting in the middle of a horseshoe-shaped table, looking directly at a tribunal with lawyers on either side. And I think that probably has a psychological effect on the witness and a positive effect on our continuous search for the truth. Perhaps a witness getting to sit at home in their dining room table and testifying doesn't quite feel those pressures. So anyway, there's a lot going on. And one thing, you just can't do it with a jury trial, so which is a con. And but there are substantial pros, too.
Right. Interesting. Thanks, Alan. Thanks, Sama, for that good overview. That was very insightful. So once again, looking at this from the client's point of view, what are some key differences between virtual hearings and in-person hearings? And do those differences vary depending on where you are in the world?
There are some interesting differences from a UK perspective, where we have a very staged, and I'm sure this is true in other jurisdictions, our courtrooms have a theatrical element to them. And if you're a client, you may be sitting 20 meters or so away from the judge, whereas now you get an insight, you get a camera in their face, you can follow the judge's reactions potentially much more closely. That gives the client and the advocates an opportunity to reflect on the submissions they're saying even more responsively than they might do otherwise. And the other thing is that for the first time ever, clients get to see their advocates in the eye as they deliver their submissions, whereas previously you'd be sitting as an advocate with your back to your client. You now can see the whites of the eyes of your advocate and your opponent. And that, I think, it in a funny way, it elevates the psychological process of the courtroom in an interesting way.
I'd agree with that. And one of the things I noticed in trying a TRO, an injunction case, is that in many ways, it's more intimate than being there live. You are closer up. The judge, you're really literally in the judge's face. And, you know, they caution lawyers in law school, never roll your eyes or smirk at something the other side is doing. And you really have to remember that rule, because you're not, you know, 30 or 40 feet away from the judge. You're right there, and they can see those things. So it does. It presents a different and interesting dynamic.
I wonder how that impacts the point I was raising earlier about assessing the credibility of the witness. So much has been said and argued, and I tend to agree with those views, that it is better to be in the same room as an arbitrator with the witness, the fact witness or the expert witness that's testifying, to be in a position to assess their credibility and get a sense of their overall demeanor and the way they're answering the questions. But you're giving a very interesting different perspective on this. I would say that there may be also an impact on the witness who's testifying, knowing that they are testifying in the same room where they have the arbitrators or the judge, for that matter, listening to them, may have a stronger effect, perhaps an intimidation effect on them, or maybe even a fear of not telling the truth effect on them, as opposed to if they are distanced, although, yes, close in terms of being able to see their faces, but much further away in a virtual world. And it's an interesting question, I think.
Samar, if I could pick up on that, I completely agree. And I think that issue is even more accentuated in cases where there's a really strong cultural gap between the parties. You might have a tribunal with three people from three different countries, clients from different countries, speaking different languages, sometimes from different legal traditions, who have quite different expectations of what this process, and particularly cross-examination, will deliver. And I think in that context, to put a witness whose credibility might be an issue into a physical environment like that is a very different dynamic to doing this virtually. And that's something we really see, I guess, in Singapore, which is such a crossroads. We really do see those differences accentuated, particularly in an arbitration context.
Very interesting. So let's turn to some practicalities. Once a virtual hearing is set, how do you prepare clients, and what can clients do to help themselves prepare?
First, you have to explain to the clients that the medium that they're going to be using, and it's just literally that, a medium of audiovisual communication. And we always, for example, for years, I've always been preparing a client to testify, or a witness to testify, you know, I'll say blue's the color of credibility. Wear a blue suit, blue shirt. It's the color of credibility. And now I do it for, you know, a different reason. It's because light blue works really well on video. And you have to prepare them for these things. Don't wear stripes because it messes up the video. Often white will bleed out the video and mess it up. So you have to prepare them for the technical aspects, the lighting. Make sure they have a good HD camera. Make sure it's, you know, at or just above eye level. These kind of things that are dictated by the constraints of the medium. And it's obviously crucial to teach, to explain to witnesses these factors, and to practice with witnesses, to teach them to look at the camera directly, because that's the judge. And it's also important to convey to not just the witnesses, but the clients too, how the procedure works. And usually the thing you got to keep in mind is it's the normal procedure, whatever that is, it's the normal process. So if it were an evidentiary hearing, openings, you know, invocation of the rule, openings, closings, with, you know, testimony in between. And that's, I think, helpful, is just to remember that other than the medium, the process is supposed to be the same.
I would echo that. I think familiarity is the watchword here for witnesses, and the more they can do to familiarize themselves with the process and the environment in which they'll be testifying, the better. So whereas before I might have suggested to a witness watch a court hearing from the public gallery, here in the UK some hearings are being broadcast over YouTube. So do exactly that. Watch other deponents give evidence and practice. The technical equipment, so that, you know, on the day you're not flustered making sure your headset works, you're putting yourself in the right frame of mind to give evidence to the court.
And Edward, I think that's actually a good feed into a related question as well, which is, again, if you're looking at this from the client's viewpoint, What are some of the greatest challenges that are presented by virtual hearings? And I'm thinking about things like the security of the connection, you know, time zone issues.
Well, I can speak to the time zone issue. I am currently in the midst of preparing for a virtual merits hearing. And because of the time zone constraints, we are having a difficult time, as you might imagine, preparing those witnesses for testimony and also even agreeing on sitting times that work for all time zones concerned, with a view to, of course, minimizing the inconvenience, as one should, on the testifying witness. It is, of course, key that the witness who's testifying not be put in a position where they're prejudiced or working late through the night. But that often means that someone else will be working the night shift. So this has been very challenging in that respect, in terms of not only participating in the hearing itself at very strange hours, but also preparing for the hearing. And because the sitting times are reduced by virtue of these time zones, we're actually finding ourselves going from what was scheduled to be a roughly 9-day hearing to now a 4-week hearing as a result.
If I could pick up on that very last point from Samar, that my invariable experience with these virtual hearings, as counsel and as arbitrator actually, has been that they have been a lot slower. And there is a lot more pressure, even without the time differences, a lot more pressure on the timetable. And what you think should be 3 or 4 hours can easily fill a day. I think also the time difference is really sometimes used strategically by counsel. And you can see, for example, planning a hearing timetable, we can see situations where the same counsel has to spend the day cross-examining witnesses, and then at 10:30 at night, his or her time has to deliver an oral closing. So the simple sort of hard human realities of time difference are now very real with these virtual hearings. Of course, we as arbitration lawyers, I guess, have got a head start on these. In some ways, all of this virtual hearing process or some hybrid form of these virtual hearings is not a new norm at all. It's been arbitration norm for some time now. And in some ways, I guess it's accelerating out of necessity. But I completely agree with your point, Samar.
And Kate, on the security issue, you know, I think we're fortunate because it's become less and less of an issue. And first of all, in a U.S. court case, it doesn't matter because they're public. They're open to the public, and they should be. And judges will allow anybody to log on to a Zoom hearing. And only if the person causes trouble, the judge can exclude them. But generally, it's not a big deal. Arbitration, of course, is generally considered confidential, at least the hearing portions of it. So you do have to keep that in mind and password protect the hearings and, you know, maybe keep people in the waiting room until they're permitted in. But I think we're very fortunate. I think the companies that are creating the software that allows these virtual meetings take security very seriously. And I think, you know, they're building robust systems these days.
So you've each spoken about the challenges in different respects of having everyone not in the same room, including, for example, your client. In the press, there's been a lot of discussion about witnesses getting texts or private chats with suggested answers. So I could understand there's a real opportunity for mischief here. Are there any techniques available that you've tried to ensure that doesn't happen and to ensure the process is fair?
Well, we have given some thought to this issue, which is not new in arbitration, and I suspect litigation as well, in the sense that even in physical hearings, arbitral tribunals often make sure to remind witnesses that are testifying that when breaks occur, for example, that they are not to discuss their testimony with anyone while they are still in the process of giving evidence. So the concept has been around, but of course there's added uncertainty due to the fact that in a virtual setting, no one can see who's in the room with the witness, or no one can see with any clarity what the witness is doing with his or her hands if they're not visible to the camera, for example, if they're using a device communicating with someone, etc. One of the ways in which this can be handled is by confirming with the witness that they are not in any way communicating with someone, or there is no one present in the room with them other than any authorized people with whom they are communicating. And what we've done in the Hogan-Lovells protocol for the use of technology and virtual international arbitration hearings is that we've tackled that point among many others. And we have proposed in section 3.3 of the protocol that witnesses who testify may take a broader or more extended oath to the effect of, and I will read it to you, I swear to have followed the tribunal's procedures regarding the accuracy, truthfulness, and fairness of my testimony to the best of my ability. I affirm that there is no one else in the room with me except authorized attendees, that no authorized parties can communicate with me, and that I am not currently aware of what documents will be shown to me by opposing counsel. That last point is meant to address the possibility that any cross-related documents that may have had to be sent in hard copy, if necessary, to that witness remain sealed somehow and preserved until such time as that witness receives the questions from the examining counsel. So that is one way that we have thought about making sure that we protect the integrity of the process in a virtual setting.
Even in a live hearing, often we have back channels communications, right? We have chats going on or emails going back and forth during the testimony. And it's certainly crucial in a virtual setting when you might be thousands of miles from your client and from everybody else involved, that there's some sort of back channel established before the hearing that where you can communicate. And the thing to remember is you've got to exclude the witnesses from that back channel. They cannot be on it. And, you know, I could see how people might mess that up just inadvertently, but it's something to really keep in mind. So that's just ethics, because as Samas said, you in any hearing, you cannot discuss the testimony with the witness, even during breaks, and you have to be very cognizant of that. So what about the other side? If you're dealing with less, you know, or more ethically challenged opposing counsel and parties, I think just like real life, it's situational awareness. And fortunately, the technology allows you to actually look at the witness when you're questioning them. And so you have to be aware, are they looking down? Do they appear to be reading? And what if they are? You can question them about it. Sir, are you reading from notes? Do you have any form of communication with your lawyers or anybody else during this testimony? You may ask those questions and you should be aware. And if there's, you know, any indication that you should be asking them, ask them.
One additional thing you can do, which certainly the English courts have allowed in appropriate cases, you can ask the witness to stand up and pick up the camera and pan it around the room to demonstrate that there isn't anyone else in there.
Although, how do you control whether someone's going to walk in, you know, later? I have my skepticism on this one.
The next question is, from a global standpoint, is there a risk that virtual hearings could give rise to challenges to award enforceability? And if that risk exists, how can parties minimize it while they are organizing and conducting those remote hearings?
I think there is an enforcement risk around arbitral awards, which have been obtained particularly in ad hoc cases where there are no institutional rules expressly allowing for some flexibility on format of hearings. Now, I think there'll come a point where somebody does challenge awards and will do so successfully. I think it would take strong facts, the sort of facts that we see sometimes where a virtual setting would clearly benefit one party more than the other. Where, for example, serious allegations of wrongdoing are made, it turns on issues of credibility that need to be tested best in an in-person hearing. To deprive the party seeking to obtain those answers of an in-person hearing itself works in unfairness, and I think we have to accept that. And that is the cost of having a hearing at all and resolving these disputes in these difficult times. But there'll come a point, particularly where it's not an institutional arbitration, where I think on strong facts there might be some challenge. I think it's inevitable. In terms of managing the risk, go with the big, well-established institutional arbitral rules. The rules in there were not designed specifically for virtual hearings, but I think the best view is that they are sufficient protection when it comes to challenges on these. So those would be my thoughts on managing the risk.
So if I may comment on Kent's observations, I agree with everything that's been said. And I think the challenge here for any arbitral tribunal or judge is to make sure that they balance out the rights of due process and the principle of equality between the parties. What's interesting is that there are no arbitration laws or arbitration rules, at least that I'm aware of, that prohibit the use of virtual hearings. We have seen some court decisions prior to COVID addressing questions like, is it okay, is it a violation of due process to testify by video conference? And at least out of the US, there are a number of decisions that hold that testifying by video does not violate the principle of due process as a general matter. But I suspect we will be seeing an increased number of challenges post-COVID or during, depending on how long it lasts, arising out of difficulties in connection with virtual hearings, and particularly with respect to the principle of equality, because that is where having any kind of imbalance between the parties can lead to problems. For instance, access to technology is a critical issue, especially when you have parties located in different parts of the world where they may not have the same level of access. They may not even have the same internet speed. And if that impacts disproportionately one party as opposed to another, while the virtual hearing is ongoing, it is incumbent upon the tribunal or the judge to quickly remedy these types of issues so as to minimize the risk of challenge and set aside.
Interesting. Thanks, Sima. I can imagine that we're going to see those almost aftershocks of the COVID crisis long after it does subside. So one last question, and it's a free-for-all. Are there any real-time stories that you can share that might highlight the differences that you've experienced in virtual hearings, you know, in the U.S., in Asia, in London?
My virtual hearing experience has been in the U.S., although last year, right before the virus, I tried an arbitration in London. And I think that the differences that you have to keep in mind are the same. I mean, they're the procedural differences. Arbitration works differently than a U.S. court hearing, which works differently, obviously, than a U.K. court hearing. And then, you know, we in the arbitration, the international arbitration world are constantly aware of cultural differences. There's the typical aggressive U.S. style lawyer versus more restrained international lawyers from other places. There's the well-known dislike of U.S. style discovery by many arbitrators and jurists who are not from the United States. So again, you know, it's the same issues can apply often. And I'm not sure that just using, you know, just because you're using this technology will create further differences other than the ones that are already there, which can often be substantial and that you have to pay attention to in any event.
I would agree with that. From the UK perspective, there's an additional level of complication because often on big cases, your firm's solicitors will often engage a specialist advocate, a barrister, to make representations of your case to a judge. And you need to think very carefully about the sort of barrister you want to engage. You want to engage someone who's going to work with the technology, not against it. You don't want someone who's going to rely on his courtroom presence to make an impact on the judge. So it may be that you need to think about getting a more forensic type of advocate rather than your typical theatrical shouter.
I think it does impact on the style of advocacy, definitely, in terms of thumping the table. I think it also influences the way you might choose your points, order your points, and also, I think most acutely, with cross-examination, particularly where you're going to need a number of documents or to take a witness through a sequence of questions where he or she strays, I'm going to bring him back to the documents. That's one thing in an in-person hearing where we're all sitting there with bits of paper in front of us, and another thing where we might all have signed up to a completely virtual solution and be dealing with different countries in a remote setting. So it really does impact the way we're approaching it. And we've seen that in real life, particularly with Singapore seat cases for a foreign party with, again, English counsel on the other side, who may have met a certain stereotype in terms of aggression. And that hasn't always played out so well in a virtual setting as it might have in person.
Thank you so much, Kent, Sama, Edward, and Al, for sharing your insights today. It's been really interesting discussing this topic with everyone. If anyone listening in would like to discuss anything we've raised here further, please do just get in touch. You can find all our details on the Hogan Lovells website. I'd also encourage you to visit the Hogan Lovells COVID-19 Topic Center of our website. Thanks again, everyone.
If you're interested in any of the issues raised during this podcast, we can help. Please speak to your Hogan Lovells contact or visit our website, HoganLovells.com.